Hey, it's Matt from Solidarity House. A week ago, on March 15th, a white supremacist attacked the Al-Noor Mosque and Linwood Islamic Center in Christchurch, New Zealand. He killed 50 people and wounded 50 more. The attacker was part of the alt-right. He was a violent, radical white male who killed and wounded all of these people, purportedly in defense of his race, his masculinity, and as part of a movement that he saw as being headed by Donald Trump and other white nationalist leaders. The following is a conversation about how to keep our own kids from becoming attracted to these movements. And particularly in the context of, talking to kids about the alt-right, not just to be nice. Soft liberalism is not the answer here. In fact, in some ways, sure, this is about loving people, and in some ways, it is decidedly fucking not about loving people. And so we want to know more and get some perspective. And so in order to do that, I've brought my friends Lindsay and Brad on board today. And let's go ahead and start out with Lindsay. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I'm Lindsay Hanlon. I'm a pop culture critic, writer, editor. And though I am not a parent, I am a former prevention specialist. So my job was literally to go and talk to children about things like consent and bodily autonomy. And honestly, that kind of training and that kind of content leads itself, I think, well to these kind of talks, because they're talks that you have with children that a lot of other adults don't want you to have with children. And I think that having those kind of talks and talking about these subjects with kids is a really important part in terms of avoiding that radicalization and avoiding that alienation. So I'm really pretty hooked in with the internet. I watch way too much YouTube and I know way too many memes. So I feel as if I at least kind of understand how this process happens, even if I don't always understand how to best stop it, but I have some ideas.
Awesome, and it's great to have you here. Brad, thank you so much. I've admired both you and Lindsay's stances on things for so long, and it's wonderful to have you here.
Thanks, Matt. Yeah, I'm Brad Kramer. I teach anthropology at Utah Valley University, and also in the Utah Department of Corrections. I teach at the prison here. And I have a long-standing interest in this, both as an educator, but also as a parent. I have three teenage boys. My oldest is 17. My second oldest turns 16 next week. And then I have a 13-year-old who turns 14 in the fall. And they're all avid media users. They all, especially a lot of YouTube. But they also use social media, and they are, I would say, especially the oldest, but all three of them to some degree are, I think, comparatively politically aware and literate. And so for me, obviously, there's a personal dimension to this, but kind of in the spirit of all politics being local and all politics being personal, I think some of the very most important grassroots political work that we do is literally in conversations we have with young people. The background is actually where I wanted to focus my primary attention today. You can talk about specific curriculum. You can talk about the specific research that parents need to be doing if they want to have informed discussions with their kids about this, especially with their sons about this, if we're being honest. And I'm fine having that conversation, but there is, as you know, some background and some preliminary work and some preliminary understandings that have to be built into this process from the outset, or else we're not going to get anywhere. So one of those is just the communication framework that you have with your kids. So establishing patterns of open and candid lines of communication with your kids that you establish prior to adolescence, that you establish in the years leading up to the time that they are susceptible to radicalization. So if these patterns are already in place, it makes the conversations significantly easier. It makes it easier to involve yourself in their sort of online lives, to speak the language that they speak, and to have just open trust. I mean, we all remember what it was like to become a teenager, and one of the things that happens is that your trust in your parents' judgment of the world is no longer unconditional. And so if you have these established patterns in place, you know, that can be it's an absolutely essential precondition. And I know there are strategies that my spouse and I have pursued in order to do this over the years, but I assume that's going to vary a little from family to family. But for us, it involves everything from just having regular contact with the kids, starting when they start elementary school. So when they go to kindergarten, we start having monthly kind of sit down chats with them, and that we won't lie to them. These sort of chats, these meetings that we have with the kids, are how they learn that Santa Claus isn't real, and how they start to learn about sex and things like that. It always comes up in the context of this. And then because we have them every month, the kids will very often say something like, "Oh, I have something I want to ask you about at our next meeting," that kind of thing. So you put that pattern into place at the outset. And honestly, when they're children, pre-adolescent, with the exception of some of those big issues that I mentioned, I mean, you know, I'm sort of half kidding when I say Santa Claus, but that's a big deal to kids. But you know, they learn about sex and they learn about bodies and stuff. But honestly, a lot of the stuff is totally mundane. It's almost silly. They just ask really dumb questions all the time. But having those conversations about really dumb questions and having them ask you totally random things and asking them really mundane things about their lives, it just, again, it puts that pattern into place, because you're not going to be able to have conversations about serious things if you can't have conversations about unserious things.
Lindsay, I wanted to get from you some account of general thematic description of what kids are seeing on the internet, and how these weird, because it is weird, it's a very strange process that is configural. It is not propositional. It's not like white supremacists are posting videos making arguments. There's something else going on in this mess of videos and memes and all of that. And I'm sounding old, even though I'm kind of a shit poster myself. What's the description of that? How would we categorize and describe the cultural experience that we're talking about here?
And so there's a couple things that you have to understand about, first of all, how YouTube works, and second of all, how this process works on YouTube. And so one of the most important things is the YouTube algorithm, which is this fairly mysterious thing that they don't like to talk about very much because it leads to them admitting that they're kind of monetizing radical content. YouTube's main purpose is to make sure that you spend more time on YouTube. YouTube's main purpose is not to show you alternative ideas or to challenge any of your concepts. Its main purpose is to make sure you spend even more time on YouTube. And one of the ways it does that is with those recommended videos that you see at the end of a video. And those videos can really kind of act as kind of breadcrumbs on a trail from fairly normal-ish propositions to fairly radical propositions, without you really realizing that the content is changing very much, or without you realizing that it has gone from that kind of normal standpoint to this more radical standpoint. So, for example, there's a few figures that I kind of conceive of as quote-unquote gateway figures. People like Jordan Peterson, Ben Shapiro, Blair White, and a few other people like that are kind of the normalized face of a lot of this kind of content. But then if you go to their pages and you start watching their videos, then you're going to start getting recommendations that take you to more and more extreme people. And because they're recommended because you saw this former video, especially if you're a kid, the assumption kind of is, oh, if I liked this person, I'm going to like that person. And you kind of go down that hole. And so, for example, I just kind of did an experiment with myself last night, and I started on a Jordan Peterson video that was, I think, about free speech. And after just a few recommended video clicks, I ended up with some sort of SJW trans person gets owned by such and such on YouTube, et cetera, et cetera. So you start getting from kind of normal propositions to these really radical propositions fairly quickly. And it's not in YouTube's interest to really challenge you. So if you're showing this interest in this radical content, it's not really in YouTube's interest to start showing you something that challenges that content. So the people who are going into these videos are not necessarily going to be getting a wide range of opinions. They're going to be getting more things that confirm what they already said.
Yeah, so one of the things that we need to discuss here is the kind of counterintuitive connection between normalization and radicalization. So ideas that would formerly have been considered fairly verboten or beyond the pale are becoming increasingly normalized in this kind of in this sort of like pop media culture, this sort of YouTube culture, this online culture. And that makes kids who are either naive or desensitized more susceptible to this sort of gateway into radicalization that Lindsay's describing. And one of the things that we have, I think there are a couple of dimensions that we have to talk about when we're focusing on the susceptibility side. Like, what is it about our kids that potentially makes them susceptible to this increasingly normalized, but at the same time, radical discourse? I mean, there are certain ideas that you can float with your kids. There are certain things you can try to teach your kids about tolerance, and you can try to teach your kids about privilege. You know, you can kind of try to go through and methodically deconstruct modern ideas about race. I mean, those are all, you know, potential ideas to explore. And if your kids are in the right frame of mind and asking the right questions, these things can be helpful. But I think there are deeper underlying issues that we sometimes fail to focus on. One of them is humor and the role that humor plays in all of this. One of the most, I think, essential characteristics of contemporary fascism is irony. And some of this is just related to a kind of point that I try to make when I talk about race and racism with my college students. The idea that there's a difference between the kind of racist who tells racist jokes and the kind of racist who laughs at them. And even when you're talking about the kind of people that laugh at racist jokes, I think it falls into kind of two categories. There are people who laugh at racist jokes because they find the racial content amusing, like they actually find the substance of it funny. And then there are people who laugh at racist jokes solely on the basis of provocation. So it's the shitposting side of online fascism that I think plays an enormous role in susceptibility, in sort of normalization and the susceptibility to radicalization. The idea that you are doing something funny by triggering sensitive people, even if you say to yourself, well, I don't even actually agree with the content, I think it's ridiculous, but it's just really funny to say these offensive things and to watch liberals lose their minds over it or something. The provocation, the provocative, ironic humor side of things is just really, really, really deadly when it comes to this entanglement of normalization and radicalization. Mm-hmm. The other thing we can you know, separate these out. I assume Lindsay's going to have a lot to say about this, but the other thing that I want to mention is that when we're talking about the alt-right, we have to remember that this is not just racism we're combating, it's fascism, which also means that it's sexual violence. Fascism always, in every manifestation that we've ever known for it to exist in the world, including what the soft fascism that we're seeing on the rise in the United States and American politics and right in the White House, is always connected to sexual violence. It's always connected to male sexual entitlement, and to a kind of willful indifference to sexual trauma and a weaponization of sexual trauma. And so this goes back to this question of what are you doing in the, you know, prior to having a conversation specifically about the alt-right, what are you doing to inoculate your sons in particular against radicalization? And a big part of that is you have to be talking to them about sex and about consent and about autonomy and about respect and about entitlement. And they have to have healthy ideas about sexuality and sexual expression and sexual relations going in, because it is toxic ideas about sexuality. So sort of unchecked or just like unexamined, unself-conscious toxic ideas about sexuality are part of what make these young men susceptible.
I remember seeing in the rise of Trumpism this synthesis of other types of fascism, racist and sort of nationalism and sort of violent hierarchies, with this glorification of sexual violence. I thought this is such a textbook case of what we're talking about.
So as Brad said, this sense of entitlement and especially this kind of misunderstanding of the relationship between individuals and sex and gender and all that kind of stuff is, for me, really often a ground zero for this radicalization. I mean, if you take a Venn diagram of gamer gators and people who are being attracted to the alt-right, it's very close to a circle. A lot of the people who are being kind of led to this movement really get their start in this sense of entitlement and this sense of anger, even, regarding sex and regarding what they see as their right versus what they see as actually happening. And so where a lot of this alienation starts for a lot of these young men is the idea that they should be having sex, they should have a girlfriend, they should have a partner, and they're not getting one, and that is an injustice. It's not just, you know, something that happens when you're 16. It is something that's being withheld from them that they were promised.
This is not your derivation. This is not your, like, some interpretation. This is what they are saying. They are saying, all these artifacts that are the videos they make, the posts that they make, all of that, they're explicitly saying that. I wanted to name that this is not you, you know, coming in and being Dr. Lindsay.
I appreciate that. Yeah, so a lot of them are saying right out, I'm very angry because I don't have a girlfriend. If you go to like incel message boards and things like that, they're just awash with these young men who in some ways are sympathetic because all of us know what it feels to like to be alienated and all of us know what it feels like to feel very lonely. But the difference is how they react to that alienation. And so, for example, if I'm lonely, I'll probably try and go find a couple of friends. If they're lonely, they go onto this message board and complain about, excuse my language, what bitches women are and how they're being deprived of something and how there's all these Chads and Stacys who are making the world terrible and how their lives would be so much better if someone liked them and how they're really nice guys. And so why don't they have these things that they were kind of promised by culture, basically? Culture is telling these young men that having a girlfriend is both something that has to happen in order for them to be men, that if they continue to be virgins, if they continue to be alone, they are less than men. And it's also something that they're told is basically their right as men to have, that one of the ways that they can tell that they're men and one of the ways that they know that they're superior is if they have a girlfriend.
I increasingly believe that an enormous percentage of people who end up sort of submitting to the radicalization that we tend to think of in ethno-nationalist terms, that they become racist and white supremacists and fascists in this regard, they arrive there because they're already incels. Mm-hmm. And being an incel opens you up to this. And I mean, I have had, like, I'm going to be honest, like, I'm pretty confident in the success so far I've had with my sons in sort of helping to prevent or do kind of preemptive deprogramming or to, you know, inoculate against radicalization. But I have had many orders of magnitude more conversations with them about sex than I have about race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I think that's really important. And getting across these ideas really early about what consent is, how consent is important, and how it's not just about sex, but it's really about all of our interactions with one another. And I think that misunderstanding of consent is also kind of where you get to this edgelord triggering humor that you were talking about earlier, Brad, where the thing that makes people think this is funny is that they feel like they're violating someone else. And they feel like they're violating someone else's space or someone else's mind. And that action becomes humorous to them. And I think that does stem from this early misunderstanding of what consent is and why consent is important.
And I honestly believe that if your teenage sons think that incels are pathetic, that they're very, very unlikely to take seriously the sort of the Richard Spencer side of the equation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, because I think Richard Spencer is kind of telling Young men, the same thing that the incel forums do, which is that something has been taken from you. Something is, you are being deprived of something. In Richard Spencer's world, it's that everyone should have an ethnostate, and all of these mean people who think that other people should have rights are depriving you of your glory. But that's a very small hop from these women are keeping you from having something, or these feminists are keeping you from having something, and your life should be so much better right now, and it isn't, and it's because of these people over here. And so that basic concept of your life sucks, your life would be better if these people didn't exist, or if these people were isolated, or if these people were made to go away, that I think is really the core of that radicalization, that simultaneous sense of alienation and entitlement.
I swear to God, there's not a single radicalized alt-right person alive who can tell you why both Harvey Weinstein and Aziz Ansari are wrong, but the difference between them as well. And if you have sons that understand, yes, these are both problems, but they're very different types of problems, and your sons can articulate what's wrong with what Ansari did versus what's wrong with what Weinstein did, or what's wrong with what Louis C.K. mm-hmm. did, right? And they don't have an impulse to get defensive on any of their behalves, right? And it turns out, right, part of what I'm saying is that if your sons can talk about what was wrong with what Aziz did in something like the way that he apparently mm-hmm. seems to be able to talk about, just sort of emerging in the last few days, he's got a stand-up set, and it's looking like he really gets it, like he really does understand it. If your sons can talk about that, they are not going to fall they're not going to fall down the rabbit hole of white radicalization.
Yeah, well, and I think that nuance is so important, because I think that the idea that all of these things are on the same playing field and all of these things are unfair also leads to that sense of kind of anger at other things, where you get these long tirades about PC culture and how it's not safe to even try to be men anymore, and how everyone's just jumping down your throat at the first opportunity whenever you make a mistake. And they do see kind of all of this on the same field, and they see all of this as the same reaction.
Yeah.
And as you say, if they can have nuance about it, and if they can say, well, there's a spectrum of behavior, you can have things that are bad, but you can also have things that are things you can recover from. I think that's really important.
And if they understand, like in the case of Aziz Ansari, right, if they understand what was actually wrong with that interaction, mm-hmm. if they can really talk about that, the issue is not so much that some kind of structural formal harassment took place, but that Aziz was engaged, he was trying to engage romantically and sexually with somebody in a way that seemed only concerned with sort of the technicality of consent rather than a kind of affirmative desire to have an empathetic experience mm-hmm. and to care about what she actually wanted and didn't want. In other words, if you don't, it's not even just enough to think about consent. You also have to think about, like, well, okay, because you're thinking only about consent and sex, and you think my only job is to just get her to consent. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If I can just clear that bar, then everything's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they're thinking in strictly, like, consent is an absolute bar that must be cleared. But if they can think beyond that, if they can raise the bar beyond consent to something that actually involves sexual empathy,
mm-hmm.
then a person who's capable of doing that is just going to know that Jordan Peterson's full of total shit.
Yeah. I think one thing that's really interesting about the discussion about consent is, as you say, it's seen as this bar to clear. And anyone who describes or who complains about sex being now, oh, you might as well sign a contract, or you might as well, you know, sign this agreement. If you ask them, do you really want to have sex with someone who doesn't want it? You can kind of see the wheels spin in their head. Because in some ways, yes, they actually want that. They would rather have sex at all only have sex when they have a partner who actually wants the same things they want. But they know that that's not appropriate to say. And so then you kind of get into these complaints about, oh, you know, people are overreacting, or, you know, back in my day, you know, nothing was this complicated or whatever. And it's because they know enough to know that explicitly saying, yes, I want to violate someone's consent is not okay, but they don't know enough to know why this would be better if consent was affirmative.
I think it's so important to start to see sort of the chain of all this. So from the the loneliness, trauma, or whatever puts that person in a frame of mind where they are looking to videos or looking to social media as a way to belong to something or understand something or even be stimulated to something, something in there sends a signal that is part of this ideological chain that is virulently opposed to consent and to the notion of equitable and sort of conscientious relations between people and empathy between people. And that's where it starts and that's where it goes from there. And I keep wanting to, the places where I keep wanting to cut in as you're talking is, okay, so give me some lines, you know, what would you say to a kid in the context of these sorts of things. Nevertheless, I also just really like the direction this is going, so don't let me damage that trajectory too much.
Well, one nice thing is that there are actually good pop cultural points of departure that you can discuss with your kids. So if I wanted to have, I mean, and these are conversations I have had with my, at least my two oldest sons, having a really good conversation with your kids about the back of the car scene in the movie Eighth Grade, right? Having a really good discussion with your sons about the movie Blockers. And there's a character arc in the movie Blockers. It's basically designed to completely deconstruct the idea that a robust notion of ongoing affirmative consent it somehow removes the magic away, you know, away from a sexual encounter. My sons and I had a great conversation about a week ago about, there's a bit of a spoiler here, but about a sex/rape scene between Jaime and Cersei Lannister in Game of Thrones. And it was a scene that the filmmakers, that the showrunners intended to depict as consensual, but came across as looking non-consensual. And we had this conversation about where they screwed up and why they screwed up. And again, I have a son who is, I mean, he's into filmmaking, he makes films, but he said, you know, on his own, without me even having to push him there, why didn't they have a woman direct this scene? Like, why didn't they have a woman come in and at least consult, like have her look at the script, have her look at the staging and the blocking, and all of the directorial choices that they were making and tell them what they were doing wrong. It would have been so easy to just do that, but they didn't.
I'm with Brad. I love pop culture as an entry point for this kind of stuff. When I was doing prevention specialist work, one of the first ways that I would talk about relationships with kids was by asking them what they thought were good relationships that they saw in pop culture. And sometimes you'd get things that seemed genuinely good, and sometimes you'd get things like, oh, Harley and the Joker have a great relationship.
Yeah.
And then I would usually pause and like, okay, so tell me why you think it's good. And they usually said something along the lines of, you know, well, they match each other and they're dedicated to each other. And I said, okay, so that's all really good. But also there's that part where Joker pushes Harley into a vat of acid. What do we think about that one? And so it would be kind of an entry point, because the one thing that I think is really important with talking about these things with kids is not necessarily initially condemning their thoughts. And I think that's what a lot of people are afraid of when they start having these conversations. And it's what a lot of kids are afraid of, is that someone will say that their thoughts are stupid, or someone will say that they disagree with them so violently. And that's really what a lot of these people who are against, you know, Black Panther or Captain Marvel are afraid of, is that by elevating these other voices, we're telling them that their voices are dumb or something like that. And really it's just kind of about questioning things. And so I would never tell a kid straight out, no, absolutely not, Harley and Joker is a terrible relationship, how could you even say that? I would ask them why they thought it was a good relationship, and then I would try to kind of make it more complicated. So what are some things that we might worry about, or what are some things that we might not like as much? And, you know, we would have the same conversation about Bella and Edward from Twilight, or about Beauty and the Beast. And I think it also helps kids to know that the people that they're talking to are not necessarily 100% paragons of virtue. So, you know, all of us have problematic faves. Like, I will be a Disney fangirl until the day I die. And as a feminist and just as a person, so much stuff that happens with Disney should really upset me. But I can engage with that media and critique that media and still like that media. And I think that's a really important point for a lot of people, is that it's possible to like things that are not okay. It's possible that things are not okay that you also don't like. And it's just all this really complex web of things. And so I think that's a really important discussion to have, where you're not just instantly disowning anyone for liking something, but you're asking them to kind of question it.
And I think there's another entry point that we have to discuss here. And this is one that is, I think, on the one hand, very awkward and difficult. And it's been made awkward and difficult because there's already a lot of crusading around it. And it's also awkward and difficult just because of the subject, and it's hard to talk to kids about this, but that's pornography. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, on the one hand, you definitely want to talk about pornography in a way that doesn't pathologize desire or nudity or masturbation or anything like that. But on the other hand, I mean, you can have conversations, certainly you can have conversations about things like sex trafficking and sexual slavery. But more importantly, I think it's important to have these conversations because not only are the sexual relations that are modeled in most pornography that can be consumed online incredibly toxic, regularly violent, but they're also super racist. Like pornography sites are some of the most racist websites on the internet, and they're a space where racism is totally normalized, is totally just sort of cruises under the radar as normal. They don't feel like white supremacist spaces, and yet they very much are, and they're white supremacist in ways that can be difficult to put your finger on because they're not swastikas and stuff like that. And so these are great opportunities for talking about how white supremacy and how fascism, in a certain sense, but white supremacy, sexual domination, sexual violence, sexual entitlement, racism, ethno-national, all these things are sort of disguised, just sort of hiding in plain sight right in front of you, and you can't see them for what they are because you're there to do something else.
Yeah. In pornography in particular, especially, and I think just a lot of stuff actually pornography goes into a lot in terms of, you know, trans identity and how we see trans individuals and the very awful names that people in porn usually call trans individuals that aren't really okay anymore. But I think just in general, talking about how much of our world is made up of what we see in media and how realistic that is. Because I think that, again, this kind of ties back to that entitlement thing. Like if your main ideas about sex and consent come from porn and Game of Thrones, then you're not going to have a very good worldview about stuff like that. And honestly, the same thing with white nationalism and things like that. There's a really fantastic video essay by Lindsay Ellis that talks about satire and the representation of Nazis even, and basically the difference between what is happening in something like The Producers and something that is happening in something like American History X, and how it's actually sometimes harder for white nationalists to white nationalists to kind of basically steal things from The Producers than it is for them to steal things from American History X.
Yeah.
So American History X is much more overtly Nazis are bad, but also Edward Norton looks super cool when he's curb stomping someone, whereas try to find a point where a Nazi looks cool in The Producers.
Yeah, it's a great point. And it leads, I think, to another direction that we, or, you know, something else that we may want to bring up, which is not just good touchstones in terms of having conversations, but also good alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the point in the conversation where I give the most robust, the most enthusiastic possible endorsement I can of ContraPoints.
Yes.
If you can get your kids watching ContraPoints and they can actually see like they actually enjoy ContraPoints, it's an incredible, incredible antidote to the Jordan Petersonization of YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just can't keep enough praise on Natalie Wynn for what she's doing and the effectiveness with which she is doing Natalie Wynn is your co-parent.
Yeah, I agree. I also can't heartily enough recommend ContraPoints, and honestly, watching YouTube things with your kids like ContraPoints, one of the things that can kind of be an antidote to the way YouTube radicalizes people is showing kids that there's other stuff on YouTube. You know, ContraPoints, H Bomber Guy, Philosophy Tube, they're all doing this engagement with these ideas, but in a way that doesn't necessarily sound moralistic, doesn't necessarily, again, treat anyone as stupid, and takes ideas seriously. And I think that's a really important antidote. One of the things that I think is kind of hurt in terms of us trying to combat this radicalization is that it always manages to seem cooler to kids to be rebellious and edgy and mean than it is to be nice and empathetic and care about other people. I mean, I was a teenager. I was way more into being sarcastic and being mean to people than I was into asking people if they had a bad day or when they seemed down. You know, that's just kind of the nature of teenagers sometimes. And so, you know, the right has Milo Yiannopoulos and the right has Richard Spencer, and they get to have these cool slick suits and they get to, you know, own the libs at all these college things. And I think it's really important to have a figure like ContraPoints who looks amazing and has this incredible aesthetic and is also engaging with these ideas and is being very serious about it, but is also leading people back towards kind of more leftist ideas or even just more quote-unquote centrist ideas sometimes.
And just funny as
fuck. Oh my God, yes.
So funny.
Yes. Yeah, and I think, and again,
like she's modeling something which is going to be almost strange in their experience, which is that you can engage your sort of opponents, right?
Mm-hmm.
In a way that actually like shows a fair amount of empathy for them,
mm-hmm.
but it's also just deliriously funny.
Yes, absolutely.
It's such a fine balance that she strikes just time and again, just episode after episode. It just blows me away.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah, so if you're a parent listening to this and you want to kind of think about ways to talk to your kids about alt-right stuff, I can't recommend her videos about, you know, talking to the alt-right, deconstructing the alt-right, her video on incels. All of these things, I think, have really important techniques for how we can, first of all, tell what's going on in the world, and second of all, talk to our kids about it.
Also, her video about humor. It's a more...
Oh, yes. Yeah, the darkness.
So good. The humor and the darkness one is so critical, because if kids get that, then suddenly it turns them away from this idea that jokes are funny just because they piss people off.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, I mean, continuing that thought and also going back to something you said earlier about this idea of irony, I think it's really hard sometimes for a parent, because one of the things that the alt-right is doing is intentionally gaslighting people with irony, right? So if you confront them about any of their behavior, depending on who they're talking to, they can either admit to it or they can say, oh no, it was just a joke. You're seeing things, you're just, you know, overreacting. And so we basically start feeling like we're all crazy, because we're seeing these things and the alt-right keeps telling us that it's not actually what we see. So, you know, this stuff with the okay sign.
Right.
Yeah, like, of course, it's one of the most ubiquitous symbols in the world. So if we always freak out when we see the okay sign, then we're going to go crazy. But also, there's a lot of people who are alt-right who are purposely making the okay sign to communicate with other people in the alt-right. So we can't just discount our thoughts, and we can't just discount our instincts when we say, hey, I'm really upset by the fact that all these cops in this picture are making the okay sign.
Yeah.
And so...
And there I would just, you know, something you can give to, I've noticed talking to my sons and their friends, there's a, if they feel like they have something that they can, a puzzle that they're trying to figure out, it helps them to approach the question more critically. So for example, in the case of the okay sign, when I told my sons, you know, we talked about the ambiguity between a white supremacist sign versus an okay sign, and I just said, look, make the okay sign. And so they do it, and I said, look at what your fingers are doing. First of all, your three fingers are always up in the air. And in the second place, your thumb is over the first digit of your index finger like this. It's not like this. Nobody, if you could practically use it as like a test if somebody was an alien. I mean, if they're like, how do you make an okay sign? And if they put just the tip of their thumb and their forefinger together, they're faking it. Like, it's not, you would know to destroy that person or whatever in a sci-fi film.
I think the question to always ask with stuff when, you know, anyone in the alt-right is using the, well, it's just ironic, or it's just for the lulz, or it's just to trigger someone, I think it's really important to question why. and to talk to your kids about what is satire, what makes something funny, why is it funny to hurt someone's feelings.
You know, when I've asked people, you know, what do you think is really important in terms of parenting on this issue, a lot of people have also correctly brought up that the most important thing is modeling our behavior. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, that our kids, even when our kids get to the point where they're much more critical of us and we're no longer the unconditional authority figures that maybe we once were, they're still modeling our behavior. They're still modeling mm-hmm. the behavior of the adults around them and the adult relationships around them. And so mm-hmm. you practice consent yes. interpersonally in all of your affairs, and you... And you make it clear, you know, that you, if you, for example, have anger issues or different things, the issues that you're working out, you be honest about your working out of those issues. And I think being vulnerable as adults around kids is like gold. And in my mm-hmm. own parenting experience, it's often been the only thing that has truly brought home for them some particular point about behavior or about values, is seeing the adults around them actually do those things. And not only do those things, but if they are struggling with some of those things, be open about struggling with some of those things. I think that all of that is the key to modeling, because again, you know, this is, you know, fascism, Trumpism, alt-rightism are all arguments against shared vulnerability. They're ultimately all arguments against having these sort of mutually vulnerable ethical relationships with one another. That's what they're making fun of. That's what they're trying to crush, because crushing mm-hmm. that enables these hierarchies that they want to reproduce, and these violent hierarchies that they want to reproduce and live. And so I think it really does start at home in the most intimate and interpersonal of ways.
When we're talking about the subject of irony and sort of like how irony, the co-optation of irony by the right, and especially by the alt-right, and the sort of danger of irony in our popular culture now, And I want to be careful not to overreact to this, but I think part of what we can also encourage in the kids, I mean, we're talking about sort of alternate sources, is that there are really really poignant and really engaging aspects of pop culture that mm-hmm. jettison irony. So, I mean, kids like Rick and Morty, but they also like mm-hmm. Parks and Rec. And so, like, it's been encourage your kids to watch, to consume pop culture that models sincerity and earnestness, even if it's sincerity and earnestness around, you know, something as sort of bureaucratically centrist ideologically as Parks and Rec. Like the ideology there is not the thing that matters. You know, encourage your kids to like things that model an alternative to irony that's still funny and fun and engaging. Parks and Rec, Hamilton the musical. These are examples of things that where the earnestness is really, really deep and powerful, and is a really powerful alternative to a culture that's oversaturated with irony. And it's the earnestness itself that is going to help them inoculate them against radicalization rather than something ideological that's going to prevent it.
Yeah. I think the final point I'd like to make, like, that's a fantastic point, and also I would give a strong plug for Steven Universe in terms of yes. really genuine shows mm-hmm. that kids like and teaches good messages without being just super moralistic. But the last thing that I think is really important in terms of discussing things with your kids is the concept of free speech and what it actually means, and what the difference is between a genuine engagement and a disingenuous engagement. Because I think one of the traps that we kind of fall into is that, you know, the alt-right will say, well, why don't you debate me in the free marketplace of ideas?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's not a genuine invitation. They don't actually want to debate. They don't actually want to have their minds changed. They want to humiliate you. They want to move the goalposts. And they want to get their ideas out in kind of that normalized radicalization that Brad was talking about earlier. And it's really hard as a kid, I think, to understand the difference between free speech in terms of all speech is equal free speech versus hate speech, and, you know, the difference between the government punishing something and an institution punishing something. You know, there's difference between the government coming down on you for saying something and YouTube just deciding they're not going to let you have a megaphone to say racist things anymore.
Or and you, I think that's a hard, or you personally saying, I'm not going to engage you, is not a violation of the First Amendment.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that can be a really tough needle for kids to thread, because I mean, going back to my own days, I don't think we had a discussion in any of my civics classes of what free speech actually meant in the non-governmental sphere. You know, we learned about, you can't say fire in a theater, and, you know, the ACLU will protect KKK rallies. There you have your free speech lesson. May God be with you, basically. And really, so I think it's really tough when, I think it's really tough when these alt-righters are saying, well, I'm just trying to have this discussion and no one will engage with me. It's tough to explain why we're doing that. And I think that's a really important explanation to have.
It is.
Because we're not actually, we don't actually gain anything by engaging with alt-right people on their own terms. We can engage with their ideas. And I think that's, again, not to be too much of a person who is trying to get you to join the Church of ContraPoints, but that's one of the really good things that Natalie Nguyen does, is that she talks about the ideas without giving them a conversation on their own terms. And I think that's a really important aspect of this, is there's a difference between talking about someone's idea and letting that person basically proselytize their idea to a crowded, you know, university auditorium.
Yeah. I mean, one of the points that I try to make, I try to make two points in this regard with my sons, and this is, again, where we come back to Game of Thrones being a space where that can catalyze discussions, even if it models things in a sort of a an unhelpful way. And that's that debate in general, I mean debate in the sense of, like, we're literally going to, like, stage a planned verbal interaction in which in real time we're going to debate the issues or something, is a really terrible, terrible way to adjudicate truth, you know?
Yeah,
sure. And the analogy I go do with my kids is the trial by combat, right? The idea that two people are going to fight, and then then whoever wins is going to determine whether or not somebody was guilty of a crime, right? Debating is much more akin to trial by combat than it is to scientific method.
The problem with with these invitations to trial by combat, which I think is a great analogy, is that it does sort of assume that our conversations are really just little weapons that we can use against each other.
Yeah.
And strategically using each other. And that is very different from a lot of different other types of communicative situations.
So when we idealize weaponized speech as the fullest expression of free speech, we empower fascists.
That's perfect.
Because there's nothing that matters more to them than weaponized speech. And so and then the other side to this is to have, like, a very frank conversation with them about the role of institutions in actually adjudicating ideas, and to say, look, if I'm a university, right, whether I'm a university press, whether I'm a university department, whether I'm a university administrator, I don't have to, if you think that, if your idea is that, like, white people need an ethnostate, I don't have to platform that idea any more than I do the idea that like we need to diaper horses or something. Like just because you have an idea doesn't mean that I have to take it seriously. For parents who know that on top of all these strategies for talking to your kids, you're wanting to become better informed, I just want to give a plug to some direct resources that you can find.
Oh, sure.
The Anti-Defamation League has a great FAQ on youth and radicalization, and has a great database on hate symbols, and an awareness of these things. Engaging with that FAQ and engaging with that database, and especially looking at like recent entries in the database and stuff like that, it can make you, it can empower you as a parent to know what, like, it, it, it fascism, online fascism, is a rapidly mutating virus.
Mm-hmm. And really just a lot of the people who are kind of in that sphere with ContraPoints, Angie Speaks and Peter Coffin both engage with a lot of these types of ideas. Peter Coffin especially has a really interesting take on how people are attracted to people like Jordan Peterson, and how in the marketplace of ideas, really our currency is attention, and how we need to kind of be very careful about how we're paying attention to some of these different ideas in order to make sure that we're not actually kind of empowering people just by paying attention to them in the mainstream media. You know, obviously we need to talk about these ideas and we need to look at these ideas in order to counteract them. But again, there's a difference between talking about an idea and platforming that idea. And so those two individuals are really fantastic on it. People like Kat Black are doing really interesting work on all these topics as well, as in addition to, you know, trans identity and racial identity. And if I were allowed to babble about all of Twitter for 5 million years, there's a lot of people on there as well. So really, honestly, one of my best suggestions is just to go to the same types of things that your kids are going to. See where they live, see what platforms they're on, and see what better people there are on those platforms. Because, you know, YouTube itself is not inherently evil. YouTube is helping spread evil, but it is also helping to spread good. And so there's a lot of people that you can kind of turn your children towards or look towards yourself in order to be engaged in the same kind of media sphere without necessarily engaging with these more toxic ideas.
I hope this conversation was as helpful for you as I feel like it has been for me. If you like this conversation, if this kind of discussion is helpful to you, if you like our other material, our interviews with people that are really making a difference, our stories of movement toward a more cooperative society, please support us on Patreon. It's patreon.com/solidarityhouse, and it is the only way, literally the only way, that we can continue to bring you these kinds of discussions and the kind of stuff that we're doing from our commune here in Laramie, Wyoming. So this is Matt for Solidarity House saying thank you for listening.